The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Horn of Africa was the big story last year. It will be the big story this year. Transitions in Sudan, transitions in Ethiopia, and this key election in Somalia. So just focusing on those last two. Ethiopia is supposed to have elections now in August, Somalia by the end of the year. For Ethiopia, this would be the first democratic election since 2005, and this is a population of 100 million people. In Somalia, it would be sort of slowly moving away from that failed state that has been sort of stuck in since the 1990s. Challenges in Ethiopia, if you are going to have a democratic election, where you're going to change all of the rules of the game, where you're really genuinely committed for people to vote, that means a whole host of things that are going to be challenging. And they're not really up to speed yet. They haven't really started voter registration. They haven't released the electoral regulations. They've decided to have this election in August, which is the height of the rainy season. I mean, knowingly, they've only called it tentative.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 3rd, 2020. The population of Africa is projected to double by 2050, giving the continent one quarter of the world's people by then. Nigeria alone will have a larger population than the United States. To the extent they aren't so already, the world's problems and opportunities will be Africa's too. And African problems and opportunities will also be the world's to deal with. I spoke about developments in African politics and international engagement with two experts from the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, its director, Judd Devermont, and one of its senior associates, Emilia Colombo. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 516, A Trip Around Africa with Judd Devermont and Emilia Colombo. Judd, let's start with you. Let's talk about U.S. policy towards Africa and where it has gone since the last time we spoke about a year ago, because I know everyone out there has listened to the last Lawfare podcast episode where we chatted.
On repeat.
Absolutely, because they care. Let's talk first about Prosper Africa. What is it and what prospects does it have to move from potential to actual impact?
Prosper Africa probably is the best initiative that has come out of this administration, announced by then National Security Advisor John Bolton, but it kind of got stuck for almost 6 months. So, I mean, we didn't hear what was happening with it. Big launch then in Maputo. We saw the fleshing out of this policy, which it was addressing a problem that has long been standing, right? Like, how do you as a business access all of the different sort of benefits that the U.S. government provides to support investment in Africa? And we get this big announcement, and then again, we're back to nothing. So unfortunately, Prosper Africa is still a great idea that we haven't seen come to fruition.
Do you know if there are any advocates at the higher levels of the State Department, the Commerce Department, or others who are pushing it, or is it just languishing?
Well, I think one of the problems is that a couple of the key folks who are pushing it initially have left, and then there's been a sort of a bureaucratic tussle over who owns it, whether it's Commerce or USTR or State or the NSC, and they haven't really fleshed out more than besides that it's going to be a one-stop shop and will help you navigate our system There's a lot more they could be doing on messaging. There's a lot more they could be doing on identifying sectors that U.S. companies would have a really competitive advantage of vis-a-vis China. And most importantly, they're not addressing the enabling environment, which is why most U.S. companies don't want to invest in Africa, because they're worried about corruption or risk, et cetera. And all of this is about what we can do, not about what we can do with the Africans to increase the investment opportunities.
Well, let's talk about that other side, too. Talk about what U.S. government officials have been talking about in 2019 and early 2020, their words, their actions about human rights abuses, elections, corruption, those very things you're worried about.
If the best part about the John Bolton speech was that he talked about Prosper Africa, the worst part was he talked almost exclusively about Russia and China and didn't say the word democracy once. And if you looked at a lot of the documents, it really didn't seem like it was going to be a big part of this policy under this administration. But lo and behold, 2019, I think we've turned the page, and I've been really impressed with and pleased by sanctions on corrupt individuals, visa bans on folks who were perhaps election spoilers, recently going after someone who was anti-LGBT in Tanzania. And then we saw some strong statements about the upcoming elections in Guinea, about democratic backsliding in Benin. So all of a sudden, we went from we're not here to talk about democracy and government in sub-Saharan Africa to a number of small but really important initiatives that really, I think, get us back to where we have been in the past, which is pushing for these things because we think they are better for counterterrorism. We think they're better for investment. We think they're better for development and improving the lives of Africans.
So that's on the good side. But that is paired by the bad side, that there are signs of some real problems too, like proposed drawdowns of U.S. forces, pulling away from bases, cutting some support. Talk through a little bit of that as well.
I mean, it's policy, so it's a mixed bag, right? Ups and downs. So unfortunately, the big challenge in 2020 is whether or not DOD is going to pull back its forces in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, we're probably not talking about our base in Djibouti and the bulk of U.S. military that is there in the East Africa fighting against al-Shabaab and in the larger region. What they're talking about is West Africa. And Secretary Esper has said that we haven't made a decision yet, but I think all signs look like they're going to dramatically pull back what we have in West Africa. And I think this is going to be a really bad sign for our partners who have asked us to be there. It's not like in some other places. I mean, they've number of the leaders and the French have come out and said, please don't leave. I think that ultimately we're going to decide this is a bad decision, and then we'll go back in and sort of make these investments again as we did in the 90s. And then finally, I think many of your audience may think about military as just military, but truth is, your diplomats sit on top of these military folks, your development officers. It means that we aren't going to be able to access vulnerable communities from any of our sort of elements of power.
Mm-hmm. That sounds depressing.
Yes.
Yeah. Amelia, let's bring you in here and get more specific. Judd talked about sub-Saharan Africa writ large, but let's start in the southeast and kind of move our way up and around the continent. Mozambique is going in the wrong direction. What's up with that?
What's up with that, indeed? It's a twofold problem, I'd say, particularly in terms of security. I mean, first of all, of course, you have the people who are causing the violence both in the north in Cabo Delgado, and then more in the center, that armed RENAMO wing protesting the political agreement that the group came to with the government. Violence in Cabo Delgado specifically continues pretty much unabated. The insurgents have actually done an outstanding job at avoiding some of the strategic mistakes that often lead to a group's downfall. They appear to be strengthening their position along the coast rather than just rashly expanding throughout the province. They have used strategic violence pretty effectively to intimidate locals, cause them to flee en masse, and to make the government look weak. I think even at the beginning of 2019, we already see that the attacks are increasing in frequency and complexity, which also suggests that the recruitment is going well. That brings us to the other side of the story. What's the government doing and how is that impacting violence? And the government's response has been pretty weak, and to the extent they have responded, it's been wrong. Like, you need a whole of government approach. It's not just about the military. You need to reach out to the community. You need to undercut the causes of the violence as well as the people causing the violence. And in terms of Cabo Delgado specifically, we see way more stories about military brutality than we do about military efforts to sort of court the civilians, to provide them with services, to build trust between the civilians and themselves. And what we've seen throughout the world, and studies have shown time and again, is that the more brutal a security service is, the more likely we are to see recruitment for the insurgents increase as civilians on that side.
Amelia, is this one of those many cases where lessons that governments could have learned from other countries in sub-Saharan Africa simply aren't being learned and they're making the situation worse for themselves?
It really, really feels that way. You know, just looking at insurgency theory, looking at studies of insurgencies around the world, the Mozambican government is actually committing some pretty classical errors where they just come in focused, you know, we have military, we have violence. And I get it. You have violence. You have people shooting others. So your response is, let's shoot back. Let's get rid of those people. But in Mozambique's case, they don't have a military that's particularly effective at that kind of counterinsurgency operation. And those kinetic strikes, those military operations, aren't being supported with civilian-focused operations, community building, economic opportunities, building trust with the locals, and trying to undercut the insurgents in that soft power sort of way.
What is the role of outside actors here, either already in the conflict or in terms of potential intervention to help the government or the insurgents?
So honestly, I expect that throughout 2020, we will see more outside actor involvement than we have up till now. UC basically said as much in the UK recently when he, at the business forum, when he said, we need outside support to resolve the security situation. So I expect we'll see more of it. But honestly, in the short term, maybe there will be some impact. But really looking long term for the long term stability of the province, outside support will not be effective unless the Mozambican government comes up with a strategy to deal with the violence in Cabo Delgado, a whole of government strategy. And really, if foreign powers want to help, I think that's where you start. You sit UC's government down and you ask them, what's the plan? How can we help you develop the plan? And how can we help you find and create sort of the political will and momentum to see it properly implemented? As for the insurgents, they seem to be doing quite well on their own with what they have at their disposal. And they may not see a need to create a dependency on foreign actors or to compromise what their end game may be to accommodate a foreign partner. And I think there's a certain risk involved with bringing in foreign actors for either side, because those foreign actors are self-motivated. They're not necessarily doing this out of the kindness of their heart. And if something changes in their domestic political calculus, they can pull out as quickly as they jumped in and leave either side in a worse position than when they began.
Yeah. Judd, let me say something I never imagined I would say, which is let's move up to the Horn of Africa, where things actually were looking more optimistic and more positive. We have elections scheduled in both Ethiopia and Somalia this year. Will they happen? And if not, why not?
Horn of Africa was the big story last year. It will be the big story this year. Transitions in Sudan, transitions in Ethiopia, and this key election in Somalia. So just focusing on those last two. Ethiopia is supposed to have elections now in August, and Somalia by the end of the year. For Ethiopia, this would be the first democratic election since 2005, and this is a population of 100 million people. In Somalia, it would be sort of slowly moving away from that failed state that has been sort of stuck in since the 1990s. Challenges in Ethiopia, if you are going to have a democratic election where you're going to change all of the rules of the game, where you're really genuinely committed for people to vote, that means a whole host of things that are going to be challenging. And they're not really up to speed yet. They haven't really started voter registration. They haven't released the electoral regulations. They've decided to have this election in August, which is the height of the rainy season. I mean, knowingly, they've only called it tentative. But this is, David, where we should put a lot of emphasis on. If this election goes right, if Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who just won the Nobel Prize, is able to move this country along, both as a democratic and inclusive nation that is open for business, which has not really been the case in the previous regime, it could be transformative. On Somalia, it's a little different story. So they have had elections now. They had elections in 2012. They had an election in what was 2017. And each one of those, they get a little better, a little more representative, a little more inclusive. This one is supposed to be the first one where you have one person, one vote. But we're nowhere near that standard.
So talk about what has been happening. If not one person, one vote, just how bad has it been?
Well, it's the system that they have. So it's not that they are necessarily corrupt, although there's a tremendous amount of money in the process. But what has happened is that you have local communities appoint elders, and then those elders are the ones that vote for who the president is. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a negative or a positive. But
it doesn't sound that different than the Electoral College. So we really can't point fingers, can we?
Yeah, I have no problem with the way they do it, as long as Somali people think this is the best way to elect their leaders. But they have, with the international community, tried to march towards this other standard. And difficult in part because lots of Somalia is still under control of al-Shabaab. It's challenging because it's a federal system, or it has become a federal system, and the president... President Farmajo, which means cheese, and he's used to work in municipal government in Buffalo, New York. But President Farmajo is in a fight with most of the other federal states, and he's trying to impose his people. And I think we're going to see slippage again. We saw slippage the last time, and I think that's where we are. In fact, most people will even say elections in Somalia, 2020, 2021.
And when you talk about elections in Somalia, you're defining Somalia narrowly, because there won't be voting in the al-Shabaab controlled areas, and there won't be voting in Somaliland,
right.
I'm assuming, for
right,
this
yeah.
government.
Not in Shabaab territories, and then not in Somaliland, but in Puntland and in the other federal member states.
Okay. So there is hope.
I think that it's a problem that we should work on, right? Like, I wouldn't count it out, but it does mean consistent pressure, working through some of these issues. And I saw in the last election cycle that we were too slow in the draw, and that's how it slipped multiple months. And I worry that's going to be the case with this time around. In fact, we're messaging it already that it may not happen in 2020.
Back to Ethiopia for a moment. Last time we spoke, we talked about just having this youthful, energetic leader and how much potential there would be to move through some of Ethiopia's longstanding issues. What progress has he made, not just on issues of government corruption and the administration of government, but on the ethnic tensions that have driven so much of Ethiopian politics for decades?
I say something a little controversial on Ethiopia, and there's this whole debate around whether Abiy should have gotten the Nobel Prize. And people say, well, it was too early. I think it was too late. I think that when he came in 2018, all of the message was right. Love wins was what he said. And I think he brought a breath of fresh air to a system that was clearly crumbling and cracked. In these last couple of years, we saw some coup attempts against him. We saw an increased violence between different communities. He has gone after his own detractors in a very aggressive way. He has not carried along the rest of the former party. So he's created a new party called the Prosperity Party, and a key faction that's associated with the old regime, the Tigrayan ethnic group, is not part of it. So there's a lot of issues, I think, that Abiy's still working on. It doesn't mean that we can't have a great result ultimately in Ethiopia, but we need to get away from sort of the laudatory commentary and get into sort of what's happening and what does Abiy need to do to move the country forward.
Emilia, let's move geographically a little farther over. Let's talk about Chad, Niger, Mali, Mauritania, Burkina Faso, the Sahel overall. And I'll refer to the overall area, but feel free to drill down to give specific examples. We've had ups and downs in the security, in particular in the Sahel, over the last, say, 15 years. How has that evolved in the last year or so? And what lessons might there be in the Sahel experience for what we just talked about regarding Mozambique?
I think this is an excellent question. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned. And if I were a member of the new state government, I would probably reach out to my friends in the Sahel and have a great heart-to-heart about some parallels between the security situations. Since 2016, we've seen a fivefold increase in militant attacks in the Sahel. And we expect that these attacks will worsen throughout 2020. As we've sort of alluded to, some of the Western powers in the Sahel are rethinking their role there. But at the same time, the local security services are in no position to counter what various militant groups in the Sahel are up to. If anything, their activities, the security services activities, are making the situation worse, increasing the number of grievances among the locals and creating a ready pool of new recruits for these various militant groups to then expand their base, to expand their capacity for attacks. And at the same time, while there's some pressure in like Burkina Faso and in Niger to some political pressure to address the security situation in Mali, we don't see that same pressure. In fact, some would argue that the political elite benefit from the war economy that's developed there and have no incentive to see the violence abate. I think if I remember the Musi government looking out at the Sahel, I would pay close attention to the role of foreign militaries and actors. As I mentioned earlier, all these foreign countries have their own constituencies, their own priorities. And as those fall out of line with these other countries, they'll leave or they'll adjust in ways that may not be favorable to the country that they're supporting. I think this is also a good example of how mistreating civilians can worsen the security situation. We see that in the Sahel specifically, the Fulani are often at the receiving end of abuse from the security services and their militia or vigilante allies, which increases grievances and the recruitment base for the militant groups. I think something that we need to keep an eye on that's happening in the Sahel already and that I expect will start in Mozambique soon is the emergence of vigilante groups and militias, which can be very effective in providing intel to the military and providing logistical support, actual, you know, fighting support for the military. But in order to be effective, they require control from the military, from the civilian authorities. And we see in the Sahel that control is absent. And my fear in Mozambique, in Cabo Delgado specifically, is if these militia type groups arise, the government and the military will similarly be hard pressed to control them, to direct them, and will have another basically armed element to account for and to deal with when the time comes to finally pacify the area.
Sure. In the Sahel, you talked about the role of foreign governments helping the area governments. And with what Judd said about a potential U.S. drawdown in West Africa, we're really talking at least mostly about the French. Do you see any lagging in French support? That is, decade after decade, the French keep coming back in. And especially in the last couple of decades, there's been a significant investment in several of these countries. Is there any intervention fatigue or support fatigue going on from the French government that may, in a sense, pull the carpet out from the remaining support for these governments?
I think French support and foreign support in the region is important. I don't believe any of these, the governments in the Sahel or the militaries have the capacity. I guess that's one of the struggles when a foreign actor comes in, striking that balance between teaching a man to fish and providing them the fish, right? Mm-hmm. So I think at this point, these governments, these militaries, they don't have the capacity to fish. Losing French support or even an adjustment in support from France, I think would be detrimental to these governments in general. But I wonder if this idea of a war economy is true, if this idea that the elite in Mali have been benefiting from foreign presence, from, you know, the increase in cost of real estate, increase in just general, you know, purchases and general economic activity. What if that were reduced? What if that started to crumble? Is that how you get the elite on board? Is that the turning point for them? I think to Colombia, going way off to in a different direction from the continent, mm-hmm. but in Colombia, you had a long-running insurgency, and they finally turned a corner in ginning up political will and elite engagement when those elites could no longer go to their farms, when those elites started feeling more of the economic impact of insurgent activity. And I wonder, is this a parallel in Mali? If in some ways a French drawback or sort of a reconfiguration of its engagement starts impacting the war economy, is that how we hit them? Is that how we get them engaged? Is that how they feel the pain? Right. And maybe we see a benefit, actually.
Dave, can I just add one thing on this? At the end of last year, President Macron had this big summit in Pau, and it was partly because there had been rising anti-French protest in the Sahel, and the French had taken a couple of casualties, which I think raised questions for their domestic constituents. What Macron got out of that summit was exactly what he needed. All of the leaders said in the region, we absolutely need you here. We're fully committed to your engagement. And so with that, Macron was able to not only continue the fight, but increase the number of troops that he put into the Sahel. So there, I think from a leadership perspective, Paris is dedicated to this fight, but they realize that they're not popular in the Sahel. And depending on the amount of casualties they have or the lack of progress, they do have to balance ahead of an election in their own country how their population thinks about it.
Seems fair. Nigeria, as always, Judd, looms large over sub-Saharan Africa. It sure looks to me as a non-expert like we've had some negative trends in the last year regarding democratic practices and protection of civil liberties. Talk us through this trend.
Yeah, we can't do a podcast, right, without talking about Nigeria if we're going to talk about Africa. So when you and I talked last time, we had just gone back from the elections, and the 2019 elections was a reversal of a series of improving elections. The presidential election, they decided on the day of the election that they were going to delay it. And then the gubernatorial elections were a mess. Those are the ones I observed. And since then, the conflicts have gotten worse in the Middle Belt and in the Northeast, where Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa operates. And we've seen this crackdown on civil society, particularly around press. It has been really disconcerting. And one of the reasons why I think we're seeing this more than we did in the first term under President Buhari is that within his big tent political party, some of the opposition had defected. So there was less and less people in his party that were pushing back. And then the main opposition party has just collapsed. It's really floundering right now. And so he doesn't face any opposition. So who is the only people speaking up against some of these trends? Well, it's civil society, it's the journalists, it's religious leaders. So Buhari doesn't have a great economy to talk about. Security is getting worse. And so he's pivoted to focus on people who are pointing that out to the general public.
Mm-hmm. And is that just the griping of a government that actually cares about civil society, or is it something more nefarious? Is it actual contempt for the rule of law and essentially setting the stage for a pullback from democracy in important ways?
I think it's important to know that President Muhammadu Buhari in the 1980s took power from a coup. So he was in power from 1983 to 1985. He's a former military general, and he acts that way. And under constraints, he has been relatively well-behaved. But as those constraints have loosened, I think the military man in him that doesn't brook dissent has shown itself more and more. It's interesting that one of the key papers, The Punch, just at the end of last year did an editorial saying they were no longer going to call him President Buhari, but they were going to revert back to calling him General Buhari. And they were going to call it the Nigerian administration. They were going to call it the Nigerian regime.
Because he was acting that way again.
So I don't know if it's a, for me, it's not a rule of law issue. It is, I am a general, and this is the respect people should accord me, and they shouldn't be talking up if they disagree.
What about the Trump administration's move to add Nigeria to the list of countries whose citizens are banned from entering the United States? Both evaluate the impact of that for both countries, but also the perception of the Nigerian people and the Nigerian government to being put on this list.
David, this is bad for Americans. This is bad for the American economy, and this is bad for U.S.-Nigerian relations. There's about 8,000 Nigerians who immigrate to the United States every year. And this is, as an immigrant group, is some of the most educated, hardworking, successful of all immigrant groups. I mean, think about, I want your audience to think about how many Nigerian doctors they have, how many Nigerian ministers they have in their place of worship. I mean, these are really qualified people. And the travel ban is sort of insane because what they're saying is, we're worried about the threat that Nigerians impose on the U.S., but what they've banned is immigrant visas. They've banned green cards. That's a very deliberative, extensive process. So you kind of have to ask, what is really the point of this? And so the Nigerians have been very measured in their response. I think very helpfully said, like, look, we're going to start a committee. We want to have a good relationship with the United States. But it's going to take them a long time. It took Chad 6 months to get off the visa ban. And Chad's not a very complicated system. You've got one guy who says go and everyone says go. But Nigerian's a messy, still democracy, and they're going to be stuck for a very long time. And the questions are going to be, how does our economy suffer in terms of remittance, in terms of people, American citizens who have Nigerian descent whose family can't come now? And then what does it mean inside Nigeria? Because Southerners, who are the predominant population, Christian Southerners are the predominant population that migrates to the United States, are going to blame Northerners for this.
Yeah, exacerbating whether or not that's that true, tension anyway.
But it's exacerbating that tension. So I'm really appalled and disappointed by this, and I think that it's bad for everyone.
Yeah. Let's shift away from the U.S. for a moment. Amelia, when it comes to interest in sub-Saharan Africa from outside the continent, we've already talked about France. We tend to focus on European countries, or recently the uptick in Chinese and even Russian activity on the continent. But you've done some interesting thinking about the growing potential of South Korea to complement U.S. efforts in sub-Saharan Africa. Talk through that a little bit. How has the role of South Korea evolved in the last few years?
I think South Korea's approach to Africa is fascinating. I love watching them and their outreach to the entire continent. This is a country that is not hindered by colonial baggage, by Cold War baggage. They are free. And it is fascinating to me the lens with which they approach the people, the countries, the governments. So you could say that South Korea's engagement in Africa began around 2006 during the president. Okay, so I don't speak Korean. I apologize in advance if I say his name horribly wrong. During President Roh Moo-hyun's administration, when it announced the Korean Initiative for Africa Development, he followed this announcement with a trip to the continent, which was the first for a president from South Korea in about 24 years. And his successors followed suit with their own travels to Africa. Now we come to today. And while the current president has been a bit slow in developing his own policy towards the region, we do see that their current approach is focused on youth, on technology, and entrepreneurship. I attended back in December the Korea Foundation, the Korea Africa Foundation, specifically designed to support Korea's policy in Africa. They held a two-day forum, and the focus of this forum and one that occurred the day before was supporting youth, supporting their efforts at startups, entrepreneurship, this recognition that Africa has this huge untapped resource that doesn't have a whole lot of opportunity necessarily with standard jobs. Like, you have about 12 million students graduating every year, but there are only about 3 million jobs available. They need to have an alternative opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that's where South Korea comes in, bringing with it its own experience in entrepreneurship and in technology. And it is really cool to watch.
So tell me how this plays out, particularly with regard to U.S. policy. In what areas can the U.S. and South Korea work hand in hand on in these issues of technology, youth, and entrepreneurship?
There are basically three areas where they can help. First, I think in creating the infrastructure to support some of these technological advances, South Korea can work with the U.S. to leverage its own experiences in the digital economy to find the best way forward to create the infrastructure. The U.S. has launched its Connect Africa initiative, which will invest more than $1 billion into projects that support transportation and communications in Africa. And Congress in 2018 passed the Build Act, which forms the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, again, created to help emerging market infrastructure projects, which would certainly apply in this case. I think we can also work together in bringing technology to youth. There are a lot of initiatives underway to help young adults embrace technology and get funding for startups, but even young kids shouldn't be left behind. And we already see in Africa some sort of non-governmental programs to bring technology into the classrooms, to bring tablets, to teach kids coding. And these are the kids that one day will be the political leaders of their countries, that maybe grow up to be the technology and industry giants. And here we would be sort of helping them on their journey early on. And finally, in terms of entrepreneurship, both through government and private sector channels, we think we have an opportunity to address youth unemployment and help sort of develop these entrepreneurial opportunities. And we already see Amazon, Facebook, and Google investing in some of these companies mm-hmm. and supporting entrepreneurs with potential partnership strategies.
And I would think that at least some governments in sub-Saharan Africa would like the fact that the United States, South Korea, perhaps even others working together so that they have an option to some Chinese investment and some Chinese push on technology that obviously is there to benefit the Chinese just as much as the African populations.
Exactly. And I think another important sort of shift that the focusing on entrepreneurship, on technology, I think it also helps us move away from that development mindset, from looking at African countries as these poor, oppressed places that they just need some financial support, and recognizing how Africa is today, like all the opportunity, like giving the governments the chance to speak for themselves. This is what I need. This is where I want my country to go. Let's collaborate in getting us there instead of this sort of dependency and somewhat antiquated views of the relationship between African states and foreign partners.
Judd, let's balance this great conversation about opportunities with a little discussion of threats. You know, you can't be a senior policymaker in the U.S. government without looking at Africa as the potential for trouble spots, something that will pop up in the next year or two that perhaps was unexpected, that draws U.S. attention and resources when they'd rather be focusing on something else. Where should policymakers and Lawfare listeners be looking to within the next year so that they're not surprised if something does, in a sense, go south?
Yeah, let me give you a mix of expected and unexpected. I think many of your listeners are probably already following the coronavirus. There's deep concern that it will come to sub-Saharan Africa, given the large population in China. And the fact that Ethiopian Airlines is still doing flights, although it looks like they're going to reduce them slightly. There's been a number of scares. None of them have been confirmed, but the region just doesn't have the health infrastructure to detect and then to treat. So I would be really on the watch for any sort of movement of the coronavirus to the region. Number two, this builds on something that Emily said earlier on, is the spread of the violence in the Sahel. There has already been an attack in Benin last year in northern Benin. There was just an attack very early this year in northern Benin. And so this fear of spillover from the five main Sahel countries to the littoral part of West Africa, I think, is going to be part of the story of 2020, particularly in countries like Benin, Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Togo. Finally, I think we need to talk a lot more about cyber and tech in sub-Saharan Africa. Emily did all the positive stuff, so let me give you some of the negative points. First, when people talk about China in Africa, they talk about roads and ports, etc. In the last year, they've made a huge pivot towards tech, and particularly in the fintech space in Nigeria, putting a lot of money into a company called Opera, which is based in Norway, but it's US-owned. It's the second most popular browser after Chrome. They're also putting money into a logistics company in Kenya and East Africa. And Jack Ma is moving to Africa. Jack from Twitter is moving to Africa, and Jack Ma is moving to Africa. But I think understanding the implications of Chinese investment in tech beyond just Huawei, which, of course, is a concern, is really important. And I think it breaks this sort of paradigm that we have, or at least a stereotype about China does this and the U.S. does this.
I can't let that go without drilling down more.
Yeah.
So Jack from Twitter. So if you, hey, Jack, he's going to Africa.
Yep.
Jack Ma is moving to Africa.
Yeah.
Where and why?
Well, you know, he left Alibaba, and he's, you know, said a number of very inspirational things about how he thinks Africa is the future. So I'm not sure where on the continent, but he's pledged to be much more engaged in Africa recently. And I think we're going to see WeChat and Alibaba and all of these sort of Chinese, both communication, fintech, online e-commerce stuff move to the continent. And this is places where, of course, Google and Facebook and our companies are very competitive. But I think that we may not have that if not this year, certainly in the out years. And the last part about cyber and tech is we've started to see last year some ransomware attacks on major African cities, particularly Johannesburg in October, holding the city ransom until they paid in Bitcoin. And I would think these kind of cyber attacks are going to be in the uptick as well.
Mm-hmm.
Those are three very depressing things to share, right?
They are, but we're not done yet. Because Amelia, I want to give you the chance too. What else? I mean, it can be negative or it could be positive. But what else do you want us not to be shocked by if we see it in the remainder of 2020?
Well, one thing that I will be watching is certainly how the situation evolves in northern Mozambique, particularly as foreign investors in the extractive industries, oil and gas, start moving forward with their projects.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be interesting to see how the government manages that and whether or not these militias do come into fruition and how they factor into the overall security situation. Returning a moment to the theme of technology and cybersecurity and youth, I was really struck at this conference I attended in Korea. Just the excitement, the energy over technology and youth, especially considering, again, the large number of African youth, the growing number of people in cities, creating smarter cities, creating more opportunities for kids in cities to get off the streets and into technology. And it left me wondering a little bit about the kids who are left behind in rural areas, the kids who are living in Cabo Delgado, who maybe are aware that their peers in the cities are doing well and they're getting left behind to some extent. So I think one trend I will also keep an eye on for this year is how do African governments balance that? How do they implement the programs that they rightly should to support the youth in cities, to get them involved in things that will secure their financial future, and at the same time support those that get left behind? Because I'm afraid that those that get left behind, particularly in the areas where I expect they are living, they can go to a really dark place. And some of the issues we've discussed today in Mozambique, in the Sahel, and other parts of the continent that we haven't discussed could get worse. So you'd see a greater disparity among this really important segment of the population. So I tried to end on the positive, but I'm afraid I took this in a dark place myself. Sorry about that.
That happens all too often.
It does.
Judd, I'll close with you. We've gotten through this whole conversation of Africa, and we haven't talked about Sudan yet. And yet we've seen some significant activity in the last year or so. Give us those bottom lines on what has happened and what you anticipate going forward there.
Yeah, Sudan, there's this moment of real hope that they can put behind them nearly 30 years of military rule after 4 months of protests, largely led by women and professional associations. They overthrew Omar al-Bashir, who was, you know, an ICC charged for war crimes. And they've been in this civilian-military marriage to try to get them to a full democratic government. And I think that those of us who were pessimistic at first have been really surprised by Prime Minister Hamdok, who has done a number of things to kind of address systemic structural challenges and inequities in this country and trying to get Sudan off the state sponsor of terror list, which is one of the hurdles towards investment and keeps it in a sort of a pariah state. So from now until the transition, we were going to watch really carefully that balance of power between civilians and the military and how the U.S. in particular can play a role in pushing more power towards the prime minister. One of that would be SST, removing SST. Another would be falling through on a really important pledge to appoint an ambassador to Sudan, which they don't have. And then some of the donor conferences that we'll see. The U.S. was a little late to the game on Sudan, I think missing the moment, but I've been really pleased that they've kind of got back in the saddle, appointed a special envoy, been a very active member of the Friends of Sudan meeting. So there's more to do, and we should be cautious, just as we are in Ethiopia. But if you put these two things together, I mean, you're really seeing a transformation of a region that is at the crossroads of Africa and the Middle East and Europe.
Sure. Amelia, Judd, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Judd Devermont and Amelia Colombo for coming on the show. Please share the Lawfare Podcast, talk about the Lawfare Podcast. Make sure everybody who is interested in our topics knows that they can listen in to get information and insight across national security, law, and policy. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Elliot Setzer and Jacob Schultz were our audio engineers. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.